Okay, I'm going to call Anna Canwit from the City of Portland, please. Go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Anna Canwood. I'm Operations Manager for their Bureau of Human Resources for the City of Portland. And I've been requested by the members of the Portland City Council to present the Council's proposed amendments to Senate Bill 400. And City Council has offered two amendments to the bill. The first would be to change the word potential to likely. The reason for that change is council views potential as creating a bargaining right anytime there is a possible impact on safety or workload, which is extremely broad. And the concern is that when there's a demand to bargain, this can impact the ability of our chief of police, fire chief, and director of our 911 centers' ability to make decisions for more efficient and effective public services. With public safety, as you know, a demand to bargain, if the parties don't agree, ends up going to interest arbitration. That process takes a minimum of 6 months, but more in our experience, it's at least a year before the issue is resolved. The second change is to delete the impact on the workload of the employees, and in the second, that would be in line 23 of the bill. Well, I'm looking at Senate Bill 400. And the reason for that change is, in the view of the City Council, the importance of this bill is to protect public safety employees' safety. And they see that as the paramount reason for the bill and are supportive of that. They do not support it as yet another avenue to bargain over workload. And council believes the existing standard on bargaining workload that it is in PECPA right now strikes the proper balance between the bargaining rights of employees and management's needs to manage the organization and, again, to deliver effective and efficient services to the citizens. I believe we also provided a definition of council's view on what likely impact means, which would provide some clarity to everyone, which I can read to you as well. The definition of likely impact is an impact that is more likely than not to have a greater effect on public employee on-the-job safety than on the public employer's ability to deliver efficient and effective services.
Thank you. Any questions? Are you finished?
I am finished, yes. Okay, thank you.
Any questions? All righty then. Thank you very much. Are there other amendments that would like to be heard? Did you sign up, sir? All right, Kristen, will you? Mr. Hoffman. Does anyone else have any amendments that they'd like to be heard to Senate Bill 400 today? Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm going to be calling up the Dash 5s in a minute. Go ahead, Mr. Bryant, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank Steve you. Bryant, Interim Legislative Director with the League of Oregon Cities. The amendments that we are in support of were presented on the Senate side as the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments. There's a brief cover memo that explains our rationale for these amendments. They were an attempt to be responsive to the testimony that we heard before your committee on House Bill 2404, which was similar to testimony that we heard on the Senate. Specifically, the bulk of testimony pertaining to the very serious problems that apparently confronts the state and the Department of State Corrections, the Oregon Youth Authority, and the State Hospital. We believe that the current statutory language that refers to mandatory bargaining when there is demonstrated a direct and substantial effect on employee on-the-job safety is a sufficient standard to hear those concerns if brought before the ERB on appeal. Apparently, to our knowledge, those situations were not brought. Nevertheless, our amendments would require employers to bargain and discuss in a meet and confer process when safety issues are brought before us by union members. But the bill also says if there is a problem with these state employees, then let's try this process in those bargaining units to see if that doesn't address that issue. We did not hear testimony from local firefighters or police officers that there were safety issues that we've not been able to address at the bargaining table. But even so, we would be willing to do that in a meet and confer process, which is contained in these amendments. So be happy to answer any questions that you have, and we respectfully submit these to your consideration.
Any questions for Mr. Bryant?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
I assume these were not adopted on the Senate side?
That is correct.
Anything else for Mr. Bryant? Thank you, Mr. Bryant. Appreciate it. I would like to now call Mr. Brian DeLashmit and Mr. Pat West. And if you all would come and explain the Dash 5 amendments for us, please, and respond to anything else you've heard up here today or anything you need to enter into the record on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Brian DeLashmit, representing the Oregon Council of Police Association, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. The Dash 5s were essentially the same amendments that were discussed and offered to the employers on the Senate side. They preferred to have the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s, which only impacted Department of Corrections, didn't impact local jurisdictions. That was unacceptable to us. These amendments were a response to the discussion that we heard on the Senate side that dealt with two areas. One was the first being potential, the word potential, and you've heard from the City of Portland their preference to substitute the word likely. In the Dash 5 amendments, it actually takes the word potential out, so it's just a safety issue. So we responded to that. And the other issue is the similar issue to the Dash 4 City of Portland is the workload issue. We don't have any problems with that being deleted. So that, in essence, is, I think, the five issues that were raised on the Senate side, our response on two of the issues, in hearing what the employers had to say, and puts this bill in a position that we could, in fact, still, I think, accomplish what we need to have accomplished, protecting the employees, giving them the rights to be able to bargain over safety and staffing, but not putting an undue hardship on the employers and opening what I guess they explained as Pandora's box about potential safety issues. However, given that, I would like to add one additional. With the term just safety rather than likely safety or potential safety, there is always the possibility that the ERB board or someone else could interpret that different than what we're really trying to accomplish here. And I think in layman's terms, what we're trying to accomplish here is a standard in which any reasonable person, it would be the employee, the employer, or an arbiter, would come to the conclusion that the issue has a relationship to safety. In straightforward language, that's what we're attempting to accomplish by deleting potential but leaving the word safety. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Mr. West.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat West, former president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and here today representing the Oregon State Firefighters. Excuse me. Unfortunately, Bob Livingston, the legislative director, and Kelly Bach, the president of the Oregon State Firefighters, are in D.C. this week, so they drafted me to come in and deal with this bill. The I've talked to both of them in D.C., and they both agree that they're willing to go ahead and go with the amendments, the dash five, is that correct? Dash five amendments. So I just wanted to let you know. And I also need for you to understand how important this bill is. And I know you've had all kinds of testimony. But I'm retired, so I made it to retirement. But I can tell you that when you're a firefighter, police officer, corrections officer, you need to be able to talk about the safety issues before you're on the line. You need to talk about safety issues dealing with firefighting before you're crawling into the burning building to rescue someone. So it's really important for us to be able to have this, to be able to bargain it, to be able to deal with the safety issues so that we, the firefighters, can provide the service that the citizens want. And we can do it safely for us, which means we can accomplish our job for the citizens.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I may, you also asked me to potentially respond to any comments that were made. The one that I just dawned on me that I heard the representative from local governments indicate is that on the Senate side, all they heard about was problems with DOC, the Youth Authority, and those kinds of the state, and they didn't hear from local governments. Well, that was not the case in this hearing. You heard from local folks, local police officers talking about firearms that have the potential to explode in somebody's hands, exploding gas tanks, local jurisdictions, with the old Crown Vicks. There was a number of things, including vests, that were brought up. I believe they were also brought up on the Senate side. So there is obviously an interest, although the sliming bodily fluids at Department of Corrections kind of maybe took the day as far as the testimony. There was definitely some testimony about local jurisdictions as well.
Well, my firehouse is right around the corner, and I've heard from my firefighters that protect my family. And that. Representative Berger.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Mr. DeLashmit, would you pursue a minute your ending piece that I was trying to track about your amendment in taking out the word potential? You were saying that the ERB or someone could interpret this.
The Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger, I think it's important to look at the history of the changes that were done in 750. And what I'm really referencing there is that there's been this interpretation by the ERB of that under the current statute, the change at 750, that it has to be a direct and substantial impact on safety. And they have interpreted that different than I think the legislature really intended it in 1995. They've interpreted that as imminent and immediate, which is an after-the-fact standard. And so all I was trying to portray to you is that we don't want to have silence on the word potential being left out so that anybody believes that really the intent of the legislature was that we go back to an after-the-fact standard, that you have to have an accident, an occurrence that actually happens that injures somebody before you're required to bring that issue up. And that's why I was trying to think in my mind in plain language the reasonable person kind of standard. And including that, obviously, I believe the employers and the employees and potentially at the final end, the arbitrator would use the standard as a reasonable person, and they're the final judge of that.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DeLashman, I think you make a very important point there that that this does be interpreted, just as you explained it, that this is something that it is reasonable that somebody looks at it, that we mean the plain language, that somebody would, with a reasonable look at this, would say this affects safety and therefore should be able to be talked about, rather than having to look back after somebody's dead and say, well, maybe this is a safety issue now. So I think that is the intent of this legislation, is to make sure that we are looking at safety issues that a reasonable person would consider a safety issue. So I think that's a good point, and I want to reiterate that for the record. I think that's exactly the way I see it, the intent of this legislation.
And Representative, I just want to chime in on that too. Whether you support this or not, any reasonable person is going to interpret that these issues are directly related to and have a relationship with the subject matter of safety. That's why we're here. So just let it be known, anybody out there trying to misinterpret, misconstrue, in any way, shape, or form, spin why we're here and try and say it's not about safety, it's wrong. So I don't know how much more strongly I can put it. Okay. That's my intention. I believe that's the intention of the people that support this bill. And I believe even people that don't support it would come to that same conclusion. So are there any more questions or comments to these gentlemen? Representative Rosenbaum.
Just to say that I agree, Mr. Chair, with what you just said, as well as Representative Holvey's comment. Although I like the bill just fine in its original form, I think this language is something we can live with, too. So,
thank you, Representative Rosenbaum. Well, I like the original language. I was willing to move with the original language. Some real nice people came to me and said they'd feel more comfortable with the Dash 5 amendments. And since I'm such a diplomatic soul, I agreed to go ahead and look at them. And if we have the votes for them on the committee, we'll move them into the bill.
Chair Schaffler, I want to also echo that my mode of operation as billing for 28 years has been to try and find middle ground. And I believe with those amendments, that's the middle ground that we can get to on behalf of the employees.
Thank you. Any more questions or comments? We are going to have a recess until Representative Edwards is out of another committee. So, and as soon as he's back in, I'm going to close the public hearing, and we're going to stand it. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 400. Representative Holvey.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendment to House Senate Bill 400.
Representative Holvey moves the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 400. Is there discussion?
If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair, briefly, I don't oppose these amendments. I don't think they actually change things either.
Very good. Thank you. Any more discussion? Any objection to the amendments? The amendment? Any objection? Seeing no objection, so moved. Representative Holvey.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 400 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holvey moves Senate Bill 400 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that time is short and there will be many floor speeches about this bill. We heard some pretty terrible anecdotal stories in our committee about some things that have gone on into our institutions that definitely impact safety. And I don't think there is anybody in this room or in this state who doesn't freely admit that being a firefighter or a OIA employee working with criminals or a policeman or any of the other safety-related folks that we depend on, that we all agree that safety is a huge issue and we all want for their safety. What we're talking about in this bill is the potential for putting language in statute that goes sort of beyond for some of us where we want to go in terms of the ability of those in charge to control what they can or cannot do and with regard to labor contracts. I think it goes over a line that I'm not comfortable with. I would have been satisfied, I think, with the city's amendments because most of the testimony we heard was about things that are happening in state institutions. And so I will not support this bill and save the rest of my comments for a floor speech.
Thank you, Representative. I don't think anyone questions your appreciation for public safety officers. And if they do, I will make sure and correct them.
I'll stand right by you, Bud, when they come
good.
At me.
Very good.
And Andy also on the other side.
Any more comments? Representative Holvey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do support this bill fully, and, you know, I think it really is an important policy that the state needs to weigh in on. I think safety is absolutely paramount in our public safety arena and our public services all around, and I'm I remain unconvinced that you know, there's any detrimental effect to the budgets of our state or cities or counties in this. It just puts safety on the table to talk about and hopefully find solutions too. So thank you very much.
Thank
for
you,
that.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Briefly, Mr. Chair, I too support this bill. I think it strikes a reasonable compromise. I think that having talked to people like Representative Barker, who dealt with the previous state of affairs, I think this basically just restores something that seemed to function fine when it was the law, and that it's a matter of really respecting our public safety workers and giving them some fairness and ability to bring proposals forward. So I'm really glad to see it moving forward today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other? And Representative Edwards, I appreciate you pulling out of that other committee. I appreciate you coming back here to do this.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I just want to finish by saying this was in the law until 1995 and the state didn't implode. It's in 24 other states, comparable or similar language, and the District of Columbia. I don't see them falling apart. And I think that Representative Barker, he will be speaking to this on the floor and carrying it with me, as a frontline officer, will speak directly to the impact this has had on their ability to negotiate for safety for the men and women that protect us here in the state of Oregon, keep us safe, as a frontline officer, which I look forward to. So, without any further ado, Christian, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
No.
Excused.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Representative Barker and I will carry this on the floor. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 400. And I want to thank everyone who came to speak to that, regardless of how they felt about it. And I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2893. And I'm going to start off by calling Tom Chamberlain and Gordon Laffer, please.
Laffer.
Excuse me, Mr. Laffer. Well, my name gets butchered every day, so I hope you forgive me.
And it's Dr. Laffer.
Doctor, very good. That's a great committee here to keep an eye on me. Go ahead, Tom.
Chair Schopler, members of the committee, my name is Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. And I have to tell you today, I'm a little nervous. I have testified hundreds of times in front of the legislature, local governments, but today I am nervous because I believe that the three bills that you're going to have public hearing on today, 2891, 2892, and 2893, can restore the middle class in the state of Oregon. What we have seen over the last two decades is union density in this state drop from 30% to 14%. And at the same time, we've seen a reduction in the middle of class. What we know about the union movement, folks represented by unions, they make 29% more than their counterparts in other in the same industries. 62% are more likely to have health care, and more than four times have pensions. The decline in our membership coincides directly with the decline in the middle class. And let me just talk about the last 4 years in Oregon, what has happened. We've seen a drop in the median wage by $4,000, from $48,000 a year to $44,000 a year. And the number of uninsured increased by 33%. That's 146,000 Oregonians without health care. And folks want to join a union. Survey after survey, poll after poll revealed that the American workforce wants a union. But the current system for forming unions and bargaining is broken. Every day, corporations deny employees the freedom to decide for themselves whether to form unions to bargain for a better life. They routinely intimidate, harass, coerce, and even fire people who try to organize unions. Workers are fired 25% of the time. Those workers fired in the private sector. Those involved in organizing drives, 25% of them are terminated. 78% of private employers require supervisors to deliver anti-union messages to the workers whose jobs and pay they control. Even after workers successfully form a union, they can't get a contract a third of the time. Today's testimonies, workers from across Oregon, have come together to let you know firsthand how the system works and how it needs to be changed. We need these three laws to help give all workers in Oregon the freedom to make their own decision to form unions and the ability to collectively bargain. All workers you will meet today have been forced into mandatory meetings. Some of them have been fired for trying to improve their lives through union membership. Their testimony is relevant to all three bills before you today. We also have Dr. Gordon Lafer, a professor from the University of Oregon and one of the nation's foremost experts on union rights. He recently testified in Congress in support of the Employee Free Choice Act. He'll present the highlights of 2 years of research he has done on how private sector union elections are currently conducted. I'll give you a quick overview of our three bills. House Bill 2893, the Worker Freedom Act. In Oregon, it is completely legal for employers to use mandatory meetings to force employees to listen to their beliefs on union organizing, state and local elections, and religion. And by the way, federal election law makes it illegal to talk about federal elections in the workplace. And worse, it is also legal to fire an employee who refuses to attend or doesn't listen or tries to respond to questions in these meetings. The Workers' Freedom Act would simply make it illegal for an employer to require workers to sit through meetings while the employer lectures on religious, political, or union organizing beliefs. The Worker Freedom Act does not limit First Amendment rights. Under the Act, the employer remains free to hold meetings, voice their opinions, and distribute information, but allows workers to decline to participate without fear of being fired or suffering other penalties. HB 2829, the Financial Accountability Act. Oregon's tax dollars should be spent on the programs they're intended for. But unfortunately, state contractors and subcontractors are allowed to hire attorneys, consultants, train supervisors in campaign tactics, and produce materials to influence workers' choice about unionization. State funds are used to pay wages, salaries, and employees who stop working to attend mandatory meetings during which the employer tries to influence their choices about unions. Such unintended use of state funds constitutes a misuse of tax dollars and the misapplication of valuable public resources. Companies spend considerable sums to influence employees about unionization. Of course, companies have the right to spend their money any way they want. What we're saying is simply this: you can't use our tax dollars to fight unionization. Many federal programs already have this ban in place. Workforce Investment, National Community Service Act, and Head Start and Medicare. A regulation passed during the Clinton administration would have banned that on all federal agencies. That was rescinded by the Bush administration. Oregon's Financial Accountability Act is based on a California legislation that was challenged and tested in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The court upheld the legislation, so the law is perfectly legal for the state of Oregon. Majority Card Sign-Up, 2891. Majority Card Sign-Up is about a worker's choice. Simply put, Majority Card Sign-Up enables employees to form unions when a majority express their decision to join a union by signing authorization cards. Majority sign-up is already 100% legal in public and private sector elections. The critical difference between proponents and opponents is who makes the decision, workers on their own or the employer, which opens the door to the tactics you will hear about today. Majority card sign-up minimizes workplace conflict. This process avoids coercion, harassment of employees, and eliminates some of the delays and frustration workers experience when they try to form unions. Majority card sign-up is a proven approach. Many responsible major companies such as Singular Wireless have found majority card sign-up to be a free and fair way to assess workers' choice, resulting in a less employer-employee conflict.
I also might add that majority card sign-up is the law of the land in California, New York, Illinois, and New Jersey. So we're not reinventing the wheel here. It's already in place. In fact, under the Oregon statute, you can form a union through two ways. One is an election process, and if both parties agreed, through the union authorization process. Thank you.
Hey, you win those primaries, you become the president, too. Mr. Lafer, you want to go ahead?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gordon Lafer. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center. My academic training is in political science, and I have spent a number of years looking at, from a political science point of view, looking at the NLRB election system, the election system under which workers form unions under federal law, and comparing that to American standards for defining what counts as a free and fair election. Unfortunately, with the partial exception of the secret ballot, every other part of the process under the National Labor Relations Board fails to meet American standards for what counts as a democratic election. And what they look like is not like anything we would recognize as American, but more like the discredited practices of rogue regimes abroad that our government condemns as being sham elections and not really democratic. I want to take a few minutes to walk through what that case is, so you don't have to take my word for it. I was called to testify at Congress last month as an expert witness on this issue. I'm going to be explaining about how the private sector system works under federal labor law, but I understand that that's not the purview of this committee. But two of the bills that you're considering do touch on the private sector, which is the ability to use state money for anti-union consultants and the question of employers holding mandatory meetings that employees are forced to come to on union issues. And the bill that touches on the state system, let me just say that while there are some differences, the state labor system functions more or less along the same principles as the National Labor Relations Board. And I will try to do this as quickly as possible. When you look at polling data, depending on which poll you believe, something between 30 and 50 million American workers who do not have a union say that they wish they had a union in their workplace, yet only 500,000 a year actually get union rights. I feel so much more intimate now. So the obvious question is, what's the problem with the other 29.5 million or 49.5 million? And the key problem is the way the election system works. I think that when people hear that there's such a thing as union elections, they assume that it works more or less the same way as elections to Congress.
Mr. Lafer, you want to hang on a second? I've had a request from someone like, I'm going to, just for your testimony, I'm going to open up all three bills, get you on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I'm already in 2893, so just for you, and then I'll close it, the other two. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2892 and a public hearing on House Bill 2891. And please remind me to close the other two when Dr. Lafer is finished. It is. I just don't want to get in trouble with the chief clerk.
So carry on.
Yes, Representative.
Oh, yeah. Don't be too close to the mic because then it sounds bad.
Okay. Thank you. I think when most people hear that there's such a thing as union elections, they assume it works more or less the same as elections to Congress or the presidency or to the state legislature. And unfortunately, nothing could be further from the truth. Briefly, the way elections work is that first employees collect signatures of support from at least 30% of their coworkers. They submit those signatures to the National Labor Relations Board. The employer can file a variety of legal objections. Once all those objections are settled, the employer provides the union or the pro-union employees with a list of all their coworkers' names and addresses, and an election is held at the workplace, usually within a month. That's the basic framework that we're talking about. When we say an election should be free and fair, there are some people who suggest, or it's maybe tempting to think, that as long as an election ends in a secret ballot, it doesn't matter what happens before, that it must be fair. It's important to know that in the American tradition, from the founding fathers to the present, we fundamentally reject this view, that while obviously we have secret ballots, a lot of people have secret ballots. Saddam Hussein had secret ballots when he used to win 90 or 99% of the vote. There are a set of things that happen before Election Day in the American tradition that are critical to making an election free and fair, and those include equal access to voters, equal access to the media, free speech both for candidates and for voters, and protection of voters against economic coercion from their employers. And so I just want to run through some of these and to compare, to, so you can understand the difference between how federal elections work and what we take to be free and fair and how this system works. To begin with access to the voter rolls, in elections to Congress, obviously both sides, in fact any candidate, can go to the county registrar of voters and get a list of the voter rolls at any time. And by law, the registrar must make those available on the same time, on the same basis, at the same cost to both candidates. By contrast, in labor board elections, while the employer has all of an employee's contact information from the day they're hired, pro-union employees or the union only gets that typically 1 month before the vote. And partly because the law was written in the 1930s, what they get, the law says they must get the names and addresses. There's only ever been one anti-union consultant who wrote a kiss-and-tell book, and this is what he says about the kind of list that they would provide, and this is all that's required by law. First initial, name, street address, but no apartment number, no street designation, no zip code, no phone, no fax, no email. If you think about running for your own elections, for instance, to state legislature, if everything in the system was the same, except that your opponent had a full voter list 2 years before the vote, and you got the voter list 1 month before the vote, and in this form, I don't think any of us would think that that was a free and fair election, and the fact that it might end in a secret ballot wouldn't change that one way or the other. If we move on, let me just say, this guy, I said, is the one person who wrote a kiss-and-tell book, is part of an industry of anti-union consultants and attorneys that is now more than a $1 billion industry in this country. And when we talk about allowing Oregon taxpayers' money to be spent on encouraging or discouraging unionization, these are the people we're talking about spending it on. When we talk about equal access to the media, in federal elections, there's no such thing as a neighborhood or a bar or a shopping mall or even a workplace that is available to one candidate for federal office and off limits to the other. We have regulations that TV and radio stations have to sell ad time at the same price and the same quality of ad time to opposing candidates. But when we look at labor elections, and this is all legal, anti-union managers can distribute leaflets to every worker, every place in the workplace, all day long, every day, while banning pro-union employees from doing likewise. They can talk against unionization all day long to employees any place in the workplace, while pro-union employees are only allowed to talk to other employees about unionization when both the person talking and the person listening are on break. Management can put up anti-union posters, banners, plaster the bulletin boards with their information, while banning pro-union employees from doing likewise. When we look at the criteria of free speech, which is obviously at the heart of American democracy, in union elections, employees can be forced to attend mandatory meetings to hear anti-union speeches or watch anti-union videos. These can happen every day except for the last 24 hours before the vote, as often as management wants, and people are forced to attend. Pro-union employees can be banned from these meetings or can be forced to attend on condition that they keep their mouths shut. If they ask a question, they can be fired on the spot legally. And this happens in workplaces. I mean, this is the kind of thing I used to think, oh, this is like East Germany or this is like the old Soviet Union. This is what happens in American workplaces. Let me speak briefly about the issue of economic coercion. When the Founding Fathers created the world's first democracy, this was one of the issues they were very concerned with. They were not so much, you know, obviously it's illegal for somebody to bribe someone else into voting a certain way, but they were not so concerned with individual acts of bribery as with the relationship between employers and employees. And you can see a quote at the bottom of this slide from Alexander Hamilton, who said, in general, power over a man's purse is power over his will. So in federal elections, it is completely illegal for a private employer to tell their employees that they should support one candidate then or another or one party then or another, or to predict that if a certain candidate wins, that business might be bad and people might have to be laid off. Anything like that is outright banned under federal election law. It's illegal for employers to invite one candidate to office to speak to their employees without giving equal time to the opponent. And companies are highly restricted on soliciting rank and file employees to corporate PACs. All of these are laws that are put in place in order to protect employees from the naturally intimidating relationship with their employers.
By contrast, in labor elections, supervisors meet one-on-one with each of their individual subordinates. So the person who has the most direct personal control over whether you're hired or fired, promoted or demoted, get a shift change, get the hours you want, get time off to take your kid to the doctor, that person meets with you one-on-one over and over again to tell you why unionization is bad. Your same supervisors predict the bad outcomes of unionization. And essentially, while under federal law, it is not necessary for an employer, you know, an employer can't even predict that a certain candidate will be bad for business. Under labor law, as long as an employer doesn't say explicitly, if I see you with a union button on, you're never getting a promotion, as long as they don't make an explicit quid pro quo statement, anything else is completely legal. For instance, while it's illegal for an employer to say, if I see you signed a union petition, you'll never get the shift you want, it is legal for them to say that a union might hamper the employee's personal relations with the company, or that an employee's job might be affected by having a union and they should remember that their family is dependent on their paycheck. Now, to any normal person whose employees are always highly sensitive to the statement of their employers, this is a very intimidating statement. If I, as a professor, took students at the University of Oregon and said, all my students need to meet with me one-on-one, and I'm going to tell them why I think they should support a political party, and I'm going to remind them that their grade is dependent on this relationship, I think all of us would consider that an abuse of power, an abuse of my position as a professor, because I control the grades of these people. But what an employer controls over his employees is much more powerful and extensive than a professor controlling a grade, and yet what I think all of us would consider unethical behavior by a professor is completely legal for employers any place in the country. Let me touch briefly on the idea of the secret ballot. In NLRB elections, workers do go into a booth, a private voting booth, and nobody sees the way they cast their vote. However, the principle of the secret ballot in American democracy is not limited to that moment when you put your ballot in a booth. It is the broader principle that you have the right to hold your political opinions private and not reveal them to anybody, whether before, during, or after the act of voting. If somebody knocks on my door and they're campaigning for somebody and they say, are you supporting candidate X? I have the right to say, I don't want to talk about it. I'm not interested in sharing that information. What happens in labor elections is that while the actual ballot is put in a box in a private way, that what employers are allowed to do in the time period leading up to the election undermines the secret ballot. They, and this is what consultants do, they instruct every supervisor to have what they call eyeball-to-eyeball conversations with every person underneath them, to say provocative things to them, to watch their body language, to hear what they say, and then to go back to the consultant and grade every employee on a scale of 1 to 5 on how they're likely to vote. The one consultant who wrote a book said they would hold a poll among managers for $100 for managers to guess at what they thought the vote total was going to be, and they were always remarkably accurate within a handful of votes, which means that even though the ballot is technically secret, management is allowed to do things under the law that make it known how everybody is going to vote before they even go into the booth. The one example I have here is the last bullet. Former New Jersey Governor and EPA Administrator Christy Todd Whitman led a delegation of the International Republican Institute to monitor elections in Cambodia in 2003. She declared those elections to be not free and fair, and one of the reasons was that even though there was a secret ballot, there were government-affiliated village chiefs who sat outside the voting booth and watched people as they went in to vote, and that was an intimidating presence. Well, the same reason for which the international wing of the Republican Party declared those undemocratic is legal in the workplaces in the United States. These tactics are not only legal, but unsurprisingly are extremely common. And, you know, they might be common if they were allowed in federal elections, too. I think, well, if the Democrats in 2004 would have been allowed to say, we're going to force every voter in America to watch the Michael Moore movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, and only that, and nobody can ask questions and nobody can offer an alternative opinion, maybe they would have done it and maybe it would have swung votes their way, but nobody would think that that was democratic. We see here, and these are four studies done over the last 10 years that are all done in a statistically scientific way, that between 80 and 90% of all employers hold forced attendance mandatory anti-union meetings with an average of between 5 and 11 meetings per election. That 70-75% of employers distribute leaflets in the workplace while banning pro-union employees from doing likewise, that between 76-98% of employers have their supervisors meet one-on-one with each of their subordinates to communicate why unionization would be so bad. And that's all the legal stuff. And then come the illegal things, 25-30% fired union supporters. So we see these tactics are extremely common. Well, this slide got a little off in the translation, but it's important to know, sometimes when this gets debated, there are representatives from the management side who say we shouldn't have unions formed by majority sign-up because it violates workers' right to a secret ballot election. And it sounds like you're listening to the person who believes most highly in the sacredness and sanctity of secret ballot elections. It's important to know that what gets said in private is not that management anti-union consultants are in favor of secret ballot elections, but they want what they want above all, their first goal, is to make sure that there never is an election of any kind, which means they want to stop pro-union employees from ever gathering 30% of their coworkers' signatures on cards to have there be an election. This is a quote from Jackson Lewis. If the bill that restricts taxpayers' money from being used in union campaigns does not get passed, one of the consultants that you will be funding is Jackson Lewis, which is one of the biggest anti-union law firms in the country, headquartered in New York, who opened an office in Portland last year and has been retained by the Providence Hospital chain to prevent their employees from forming a union in Providence hospitals. What they say to their clients is, winning an NLRB election undoubtedly is achievement. A greater achievement is not having one at all. This is a firm that operates in Oregon that has literally written the book on union busting, and this is the book they wrote, Avoiding Unionization Through Preventive Employee Relations Programs. Their book is not How to Have the Sanctity of Secret Ballot Elections and Democracy Enshrined in American Workplaces. It is Avoiding Unionization. So we need to know who it is that we're dealing with here. Very briefly, the unfortunate fact is that the law as it stands now has our government enforcing a higher standard of democracy for voters abroad than for American workers. The elections in the Ukraine in 2002 were declared undemocratic by our State Department. Among the reasons for which they were declared undemocratic is that employees of state-owned enterprises were pressured to support the ruling party, mine workers were pressed to withdraw from a union that supported the opposition, faculty and students were told by their rector, who's the head of the university, to vote for specific candidates, and the ruling party dominated the media, largely shutting out the opposition. Every single reason for which the Ukrainian elections were judged by our government as undemocratic is completely legal in every workplace across the country, unless the law has changed. So the sad fact is we now uphold a higher standard for people in the Ukraine or Armenia or Zimbabwe than we do for American workers. What I've described to you so far is completely legal. But there is also, because labor law has no teeth in its enforcement, a very high degree of illegal activity. I did these calculations, and I think anybody who's ever looked at numbers knows that a number is only good as the assumptions behind it. I'm happy later if you want me to talk about that. But I tried to calculate this in the most conservative way possible and came out finding that one of every 17 voters, not of union activists, not of union voters, of eligible voters in NLRB elections is either fired, demoted, or suspended for being a union supporter. These are only including the cases that were litigated to the point that people received back pay from their employers. If we said, what if federal elections ran the same standard as NLRB elections, we would have seen in 2004 7.5 million Americans who were economically punished for backing the wrong side. And I think we would think we're living in a state like what East Germany used to be. Very briefly, talking about illegal activities, there was a very unusual occurrence in 2004 involving Jackson Lewis, one of the firms that our tax dollars will be funding if this bill is not passed. What happened is Jackson Lewis advised a manufacturer in South Carolina, which was subsequently found to have violated both labor law and the early plant warning notification, plant closing notification laws. It had fines. In return, it turned around and sued its attorneys for malpractice, saying, you gave us this advice, we followed your advice, and it was all illegal advice.
What's unusual about this case is not that these things happen, but that we have the court documents to attest to them happening, and this doesn't come out of the words of workers or union organizers, but out of the employer's mouth, who said Jackson Lewis, this firm now operating out of Portland, had advised them to conduct a relentless and unlawful campaign that included spying on workers, firing activists, organizing a fake employee anti-union committee, writing their flyers, and supplying cash-filled envelopes to anti-union employees. This is one of the companies that we will be funding without this law. The alternatives to this system that are being considered here in Oregon at the federal level and in other states are saying that employers should remain neutral in the employee's choice whether or not they want to have a union, that the right place for the employer to weigh in is, if there is a union, to come to the table and say what their position is in bargaining, but not in let employees debate among themselves whether or not they want to have a union. To not use public money, and to recognize unions on the basis of signed statements from a majority. Let me be clear, because it is sometimes said that if unions are recognized on the basis of a majority sign-up, it strips workers of the right to a secret ballot election. I mean, first of all, obviously, I would not say that NLRB elections are a secret ballot election in the true meaning of American democracy, but it does not remove this right. If 30% of the workers petition the NLRB, they will still have an NLRB election. It just adds a second possibility, majority sign-up, which is now a legal option to union recognition, but it's at the employer's discretion. And it makes that at the employee's discretion. So employees can decide which process do they want to use in deciding whether or not to have a union. And as Mr. Chamberlain indicated, although this sometimes gets presented as if it's a crazy idea for Mars or a revolutionary idea, it's a process that has been used in other states and in many employers. And obviously, as of several weeks ago, it's a process that was endorsed by a majority of the U.S. House of Representatives. So I don't think it's, well, I believe it's needed. I don't think it's revolutionary or going to turn the world on its head. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Just for the record, where specifically would state taxpayer dollars be used to pay Jackson Lewis to do these activities? Do you have an example?
Certainly. If for instance, at the Provident Hospital chain, any hospital receives a significant amount of state money in the form of Medicaid, and that money can be used for anything they want, including funding these campaigns. My understanding is that what the bill would do is say, if you want to fund those campaigns, you have to fund them out of other money and not out of taxpayer dollars.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could add to that, public employers also bring in anti-union attorneys and consultants. Contract services like bus companies that contract directly with school districts who get their money from the state. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's bigger than you would anticipate.
That's what I wanted on the record. Thank you. Any questions here? Representative Edwards.
Could you speak a little bit to what type of companies, I mean, in terms of size, typically get unionized? I mean, is it largely big companies, or is it small businesses, or I mean, just I don't know if you have statistics in front of you or not, but
I think that I'm sorry.
Well, Chair Schaffler, Representative Edwards, it could be two people to 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see, for instance, I organized firefighters in Sun River, and there were 10 firefighters in Sun River. It can be any size.
Representative. Specifically in the private sector is what I was kind of looking for. Just anecdotally, even.
Well, I can speak to that. I work for Hoffman Construction, which I think has up to thousands. I work for Robertson Hay & Wallace, a third generation union contractor. Our crew would get down to 5 or 6 sometimes. I think Ian can run up to 20. If he really's got a lot of work going on, but it can be from the huge to the very small. That's my experience, my personal experience. Go ahead, gentlemen.
No, that's reflected in the data as well.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing for House Bill 2892 and House Bill 2891 and continue with the public hearing of House Bill 2893. And call Jeremy Brown, Pat Maloney, Charlie Finger. I hope I got all those right. And folks, let's keep it within 3 minutes. If you can get it done under 3 minutes, it won't break my heart. But that being said, if you need more than three, just be conscious of the time, whether you're for or against. Please.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeremy Brown. I live in McMinnville here in Oregon. I'm part of the BCTGM, which is Baker Competitor Tobacco Grain Millers. I work in a bakery in McMinnville. It's called Richmond Baking. I was part of an organizing drive. I was one of the negotiators on the team. I've seen two of the people actually contacted the union asking to get represented, and they, both of those people no longer work for the company. One was terminated, one ended up quitting. I was told during the organizing, I was still fairly new, I was supposed to receive a 90-day raise, and they told me I probably wasn't going to get it because of the union might press charges on them or something. There were quite a bit of meetings that we had, anti-union meetings. They brought in a new plant manager to our work. He was a Marine for 8 years, and they told us, you know, things are going to change. We're going to go by the book. Stuff like that. That's about all I have.
And I'm sure you have no negative reflection on the Marine Corps there. As one.
No, none whatsoever.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name's Charlie Finger. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm a member of the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific Marine Division of the International Longshore and the Warehouses Union. Yeah, they get really long. Anyway, okay. To answer your question, the company that I work for, McCall Oil, in Portland, Oregon, is classed as a small company. And we went through a very fun-filled process of unionizing. And we were fed up with literally years of abuse with an autocratic manager, arbitrary rules, contemptuous disregard for worker safety, and a general feeling of disrespect. Production workers of McCall Oil decided to take a collective stance to remedy this position because all individual pleas were met with silence or resistance, and things progressively got worse. We signed 100% of us pledge cards and delivered them to the president and CEO, and whose official position for the company was, "We can't believe you really mean this." They in turn got hired Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt, which is, I believe, a really high-powered attorney's firm in this neighborhood, and proceeded to start a anti-union campaign that employed a lot of the tactics that the professor was talking about. We got things mailed to our house. We had to attend meetings where questions or discourse or anything of that nature was not encouraged at all. And the owner of the company made personal one-on-one visits to each one of us to dissuade us from actually going through with the union because, after all, it's just a small company, it's a small business, and he couldn't guarantee that anything would change if a union came in, which, after all, is big business and is just going to take our money. We were finally able to get National Labor Relations Board vote, which the outcome was 100%. And it took quite a bit of courage on behalf of all the workers. One individual in particular was facing open heart surgery and faced with the prospect that he might not only lose his job, but he might also lose his health care. And finally, what I'd like to add in support of legislation is that, you know, you guys are what levels the playing field. The company still, and many others as well, still maintain a contemptuous and obstreperous attitude towards unions. And why should they change? There's nothing to really compel them other than leveling the playing field with types of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, I'm Patrick Maloney. I'm a member of and officer of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Willamette Lodge Number 63. However, I want to speak today about a organizing campaign at Precision Cast Parts Corporation in Southeast Portland that I was involved with the United Steelworkers of America in 1995 and 96. I've been a long-term employee there. I started when I was a kid right out of high school. A lot of the long-term employees came to me and asked me to sign a card. There was we were all quite disgruntled about the way wages and benefits had been eroding and workers' rights had been eroded. The first campaign was met with quite a bit of opposition from the corporation. There was about 1,600 of us. We were able to finally get an election. We lost that election by about 74 votes. There was, and it should be noted, there was 120 votes had been contested. The company had engaged in so many illegal actions, and captive audience meetings were at the forefront of these, that the NLRB ruled that the election should be rerun. The company promptly appealed that, and early in 1996, we dropped our objections to that election and started another campaign. In 2 weeks, we had 1,175 people sign authorization cards out of 1,800 people. But what went from being a relatively energetic campaign kind of took an ugly twist. There were the captive audience meetings, and I wanted to speak briefly about what this really means. On a more passive campaign, that means that you and the general population of your coworkers are going to go into these meetings and be met with the managers and union-busting attorneys, as we like to call them, but labor consultants. And the basic gist of that meeting is going to be you cannot win, so you might as well give up now. Even if you get win the election, we'll never agree to a contract. If the company will have to shut down, will have to move, jobs will be lost. The captive audience meeting takes on a little uglier look when the anti-union campaign is more aggressive. That looks like identifying union leaders and putting them in singularly into groups of anti-union folks and ridiculing them in this process. It looks like identifying single parents from the insurance rolls and putting them in a individual meeting with a manager and a labor consultant and challenging them with what do you think is going to happen to the custody of your children when you lose your job and your health care, because that's what's going to happen if the union is successful. Now, we lost the second election by a 2-1 margin. The company had harassed and intimidated the leaders folks, there were these folks talk about captive audience meetings on a 12 during the course of a campaign. There was one every day for 12 weeks. The meetings with supervisors was constant. Surveillance was constant. And this surveillance included following folks to the restroom and standing there while their mission there was completed and following them back to their workplace. The second election resulted in a 2-1 defeat. Remember, we had 1,175 people out of 1,800 signed authorization cards, a 2-1 defeat. It also ended with 80 unfair labor practice charges that required the company to settle with individuals for sums in excess of $274,000. We talk about folks being fired for organizing. I was fired for organizing. It does really happen. Pillars in our community are victimizing the citizens in our state, and it happens very regularly. A researcher out of Cornell University, Kate Bonefender, says 20,000 Americans are fired every year for organizing, attempting to organize in the workplace. That's 55 a day. 55 Americans are going to lose their job today because they tried to engage in what is lawful democratic conduct in their workplace. So now it's nearly 10 years later since this campaign has taken place. And some of the folks at Precision Cast Parts think they'd like to have a union. But that well has been so poisoned that they're still afraid. They're still, they ask questions. How should I protect myself when I get fired? Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen? Thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to call up three people who may have a different perspective on this bill. Mr. Jeff Stone, Ms. Lisa Tressel, and Ms. Jessica Adamson. Please. Jessica, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. My organization has both union and open shop contractors, and it is our belief that choosing whether to be a union employer or an open shop employer and the choice of the employees in those organizations is indeed their choice. There are benefits being a union organization for open shop employers or merit shop employers. They have their own set of choices and their own economics that they look at. It is not AGC's position to say one is better than another. We work very hard to have good relationships with our union partners that provide a way to manage the workforce issue, and we appreciate those relationships. So I want to say at the outset, we are not an anti-union, anti-organizing organization at all, quite the opposite. But that said, we do have some concerns about this bill, and primarily that it is changing the way that we currently look at how those employees, when they're starting an organizing issue, how we interact with them. We encourage our employers to follow the NLRB regulations. It sounds like some of the things you've heard today are not allowed under the NLRB, and it sounds like those employees that face those things challenge those, and were successful in doing so, and we are pleased to hear that, because that isn't the system that's set up. It's not, if people are violating that system, there should be consequences for that. That's not right, and that's not fair. We encourage people to very closely follow the law and not step outside of that. But that said, we're concerned that despite the intent that this bill may preclude us from communicating with our employees the benefits and the disadvantages and our perspective on some of those issues. And so I think from our perspective, we do not want employers violating the standards set up by the NLRB. That isn't right. That isn't fair. We want them following the law. And if they don't, there are consequences for that, and those should be levied. We are concerned about the language in this bill and the impact it has on that process.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Tressel with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm assuming we're still on 2893.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. I'm here to oppose House Bill 2893. And there's several different areas. I concur with the comments that Jessica made. We, AOI itself doesn't do participate in labor relations with our members. We have members that are unionized. We have members that are not unionized. Some of the things that jump out at me in this bill is particularly down in Section 2, where the employer or their agent may not require an employee to attend an employer-sponsored meeting or participate in communication. Well, one, participate in communication is broader than mandatory attendance in a meeting, so it would imply that if I had payroll stuffers and the employee didn't want to be stuffed, I couldn't put it in with his paycheck. The other thing is that if you have employees on both sides of an organizing attempt, you have employees that would wholeheartedly embrace the union and others that may not. If one of those employees that doesn't embrace the union started a discussion, is that the employer agent, and are we liable for things that that they've done at the work site? There's also interesting, I thought, on page 2 on the third subsection there where it talks about awarding treble damages to an employee who successfully prevails in attorney fees. And one of the things that is kind of always interesting when one party gets awarded attorney fees, then the you know, that's kind of like, well, okay, if the employee wins, they're going to get treble damages and the attorney fees, reasonable attorney fees. Well, on the flip side of that is if they don't prevail, there's no provision for them to pay the company's attorney fees on that litigation. Most of our members are governed also by the National Labor Relations Act, and we would like to see consistency with that and appreciate your time today.
Where are you going to go on, Jeff? Lisa, what line did you start on the Section 2?
Oh, 22. You know, well, 21 and 22, where it says an employer or their agent.
Representative designee may not require an employee to attend any employer sponsor meeting or participate in any communication. That's where I believe you stop.
Yeah.
With the employer or employer's agent, representative, or designee if the purpose of the meeting or communication is to communicate the employer's opinion about religious or political matters. I just wanted to get that out there.
Right.
Thank you. Jeff?
Mr. Chair, I am Jeff Stone. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I appreciate your encouraging me to make some very brief remarks today. The OAN has not taken a position on this bill or any others that you have discussed today, but I just wanted to, the Chair had already addressed the main crux of our concern, that it's not our position in terms of being employers. Our growers have a very good relationship with our employees. And it's our hope that there are the law of unintended consequences does not prevail on these bills. We're not the good old South where we have religious tent meetings or anything like that, but our growers do, and I want to bring this to your attention, have meet the candidate opportunities that we do gather our workforce to say there's an opportunity to meet Senator Wyden or Senator Smith or your local representative. We just want to make sure that that opportunity, and it's not due to party affiliation or otherwise, is still maintained with the implementation of this bill. So I just want to get that on the record, just briefly make my comments today, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for these nice people?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, and this is for anybody, but my reading of this bill, well, I guess my question would really be, are you currently holding mandatory meetings with your employees, the purpose of which is to present a religious point of view or a political point of view? And if your answer is no, which is I see you shaking your head, then what would this bill prevent you from doing, you're currently doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, as I read this bill, under political matters, the definition of political matters includes the constituent group. And constituent group is defined further as a labor organization. So where I would see this coming in, it would be during an organizing attempt, and an employer would want to hold an employee meeting to discuss the organizing attempt based on constituent group and political matters. I think that section sub 1 of section 2 would prohibit that.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
so you don't, are you saying you don't have a problem with the section that prohibits meetings for religious purposes or other political purposes, only that which deals with labor organizations? I mean, do you have a, I guess to ask it more directly, do you have a problem with prohibiting mandatory meetings dealing with religion or politics other than union organizing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I'm not familiar with any other mandatory meetings that would occur along the lines of that. So specifically today, my concern would be with ones dealing with organizing attempts.
And a final follow-up, yes, Mr. Chair. My reading of this is that you would still be able to hold voluntary meetings where people were asked to attend or offered the opportunity to attend. is that what the way you're interpreting this?
Mr. Issue? Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, yes. The other thing, too, is a concern is to participate in any communication, and that's the payroll stuffer type thing as well is a concern, too. Sometimes there may not be a meeting, but you might want to do a flyer with paychecks. So I guess you'd find out after you did the flyer whether it was somebody who wanted it or not.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thanks. Just on that Section 2 piece, you know, trying to clarify what the problem with it is really is that I don't know that it doesn't appear that it's restricting the employer from having a meeting like this if it's voluntary. It's just saying that you can't require your employee to attend. So, I mean, I think that's at the crux of what's in Section 2. So, are you objecting to that? Or, I mean, I guess I'm just not clear what your issue with that bill is as far as participating in any communication. You got to take that in the context is that you're requiring an employee to attend or participate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I'm assuming that since somebody's requesting in a statute that the employer can't compel attendance, that there's a reason that they don't want us to compel the attendance. And I do think that, and I apologize because this hearing came up rather quickly for me anyway, and if you have the subject up again, I can get somebody that actually does this for a living.
We will have it up again.
Okay. Well, at that time, I get somebody in. But it's my understanding that that employers will want to hold a meeting where they can explain their side, their position to their employees, and that may require they may want their employees to attend the meeting to hear their side. And as I read this, that would preclude that.
Any further questions?
I just have one more question, Mr. Chair. So do you think it would be okay for unions to hold meetings with employees where employees were forced to attend and listen to their point of view?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I'm not certain, and again, I'll get somebody in here, but I think that if we require them to attend, I'm not sure if there's things that require us to pay them as well. We'd have to look into that. But I think part of it, too, is I'm not sure if, I mean, I assume the unions were talking to them all, or they wouldn't be getting the 30% or the 50% or the 100% card. So at some point, I'm assuming somebody's talking to them from the union side.
Go ahead. Well, do you think the unions are forcing people into these meetings?
Let's see. Well, Representative Rosenbaum, I couldn't answer that for you.
But I guess what I was really asking you,
Madam Chair,
I was asking you, do you think it would be do you think it should be permissible for unions to hold mandatory meetings where people are forced to attend them?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I don't have an answer for you on that today, but I will try and get one. I need to talk. This came up suddenly. Appreciate the question, though. I'll check on that.
And no one else has an answer to that either?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mom, I will check with our labor relations folks and get an answer on that question as well.
Representative Holby, you had.
Oh, Mr. Stone, I had a question for him, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification on the meet the candidate scenario. I assume if you're requiring an employee to meet a candidate. That wasn't what you were talking about then.
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, no. The way that I read this bill, and this is why we wanted to have the conversation either in front of everyone on TV land or before this committee, is to, if there's an announcement, if they're having a mandatory meeting of their employees and they want to announce that there's an opportunity to meet a candidate, to me, that's why I want to make sure that opportunity is still present. It's not requiring him to go talk with Senator Wyden. It's to make sure that they know that there's an opportunity at a certain date to do so, if they choose. So that's the part that I wanted to make sure that was still allowed if they're having a employee meeting to be able to have that type of conversation. Does that answer your question? By your face, the answer is no.
And I think we will have an opportunity for people to clarify the do's and don'ts before this is done. And I urge you all to go to the proponents, and you're all reasonable people. I've worked with you for a while. And share your concerns. Try and make it better if you can. I think we're all open to that. We just want people to be able to organize legally, lawfully, in the open, without threat of losing their job or promotion or any other kind of abuse that would be put upon the worker. That's what our goal is here. So, all right, any further questions for this nice panel? Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Nice Chair.
Thank you for recognizing that. Russ Evans, Bill Groves, and Roger Olson, please. And Bill, I hope I said your name right. If I'm not,
that was perfect.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
I was going to change it to Smith, but not one.
Okay. Well, whoever's ready, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, our reason for speaking here is to add our voice to the proposed legislation that's being discussed here, specifically 2893, as well as 2891 and 2892.
Sir, could we have your name for the record? Sir, could we have your name for the record?
I'm sorry, yes. My name is Russ Evans from Bend, Oregon, and I work for the Bend Area Transit Company / Paratransit Services, and we also have recently voted in the Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 757, to represent us. So to back up a step or two, my apologies for the awkward beginning.
Don't worry about it.
We recently requested information this winter from the ATU, Amalgamated Transit Union, on organizing for the purposes of forming a bargaining unit. And at that time, from the time we requested information, there's been a process of intimidation and harassment on the part of the company through the process. And I think it helps illustrate for the committee what typically goes on when ones do try to organize or even to request information on organizing. Shortly after this request had been made, Paratransit Services, who subcontracts with the City of Bend to run their transit operation, they organized a series of mandatory meetings for all employees in the Bend facilities of the company. And over a three-day period in January, the management and also the CEO of Paratransit Services from Bremerton, Washington, arrived, and they met with small groups, that was usually six or less employees at each meeting, to discuss why they felt we should not unionize. Also present at these meetings were all of the local management, as well as two representatives from Bremerton, Washington. So it was a rather intimidating atmosphere while we did go into these meetings. Now, when they announced these meetings, there were two employees who were suspected of, it was never confirmed, they were suspected of originally requesting the information from Amalgamated Transit, who received memos similar to the one I've provided to the committee along with my summary here, telling them that these were mandatory meetings for all employees, but that these two individuals were not invited. So the effect of that, of course, is alienation and a feeling of being threatened, possibly their employment threatened, certainly singled out and excluded from a mandatory meeting for all employees. Now, these meetings were held, and at these, I, among others, questioned the CEO of the company as to why certain individuals were excluded from these so-called informational meetings. And his response was, "We are the employer. We will decide who we invite to the meetings." Now, subsequent to these meetings, there were several employees that took the company's side on the issue, being anti-union, all ones who worked pretty much in the office there with management. And there were, for example, cases of the primary dispatcher shouting out obscenities and anti-union slogans. They were never reprimanded for this or asked not to do it by management, who was also present. Also, the then project manager declared loudly on two separate occasions, according to witnesses, that, well, if the employees vote in a union, we'll just fire them and replace them. And this has been substantiated. So quite an atmosphere of intimidation. The day of the next union information meeting, where some opposers were also present, myself, as well as seven others, this time rather than two employees, received memos, again referring to the memo accompanying the summary, saying that there are mandatory meetings scheduled, at the River House Inn, with the address. The meeting will be held in the Metolius Room, and again, as you can see, in italics, bold, and underlined, you are not invited to this meeting. Now, the following day, I confronted the Ben project manager on this, asking why did I receive this, because I had not made my position known on where I stood in relation to how I would vote in the union. In fact, I said that's why we have secret ballots, so that it respects an individual's right to their privacy on how they will vote. And she replied that, well, there's rumors and gossip that float around, and we are to issue these to anyone suspected of leaning towards the union. And so, again, a hostile work environment has taken place over the last several months. And certainly it made me feel, and other employees who were treated in this manner also felt, that they were being really ostracized and really in danger of losing their jobs because they were not invited to functions that were mandatory for all employees. The union voting was held on January 21st. Clear majority did vote for the union. The company challenged it. There was 2 days of hearings with the NLRB, which established that they found the company's witnesses to lack credibility. And the NLRB, we just found out this morning, did vote in favor of the union, that it was actually a fair election and shouldn't be held up any longer. At this point, it seems clear that the company is going to appeal that decision, and so we're kind of in limbo right now. But I wanted to make the committee again aware of the type of environment that's typical when employees do choose to even request information on unionizing, not to mention the actual voting taking place. Thank you.
Jim Schaffler, members of the committee. My name is Bill Gross, and like Russ, I drive for the same outfit. I've only been there 3 years, but I've won several awards for safe driving, passenger relations, et cetera, and such. And in other words, I enjoy what I do. The out-of-state company we work for contracts to the city of Bend, and lately, working conditions and relations with this out-of-state contractor have deteriorated to the point where we felt we had to unionize. I've had over 25-plus years of union jobs, but I've never had to organize before. And this situation here has really opened my eyes to unfair situations. Well, at least one eye, anyway. Rather than tell you about all the injustices we've endured that Russ has already ably described, I will give you my background instead. And trust me, there's a connection here. That, as you might be able to tell from the spelling of my last name, I do not have any ancestors that came over on the Mayflower. Instead, I immigrated from Holland at the young age of 9, coming over on a converted freighter sailing past the Statue of Liberty in January of 57. My parents endured 6 years of Nazi occupation in war-torn Holland. After American forces liberated my native country, my dad said he would do whatever he could to live in the land of the free. It took my parents 12 years, but we made it here. Since that time, I've received my citizenship, served in the armed forces, and this country has adopted me. Now, this nation might be far from perfect, but I'm proud of it, and I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to have a chance to speak up like this. My parents hid Jewish people in their house, and if it had not been for American troops, my father would have ended up in a forced labor camp in Germany. He was only weeks away with orders to report there when the Germans had to start their retreat in 45. Our parents told all their children about their World War II trials and tribulations because they never wanted us to take our newfound freedoms for granted. That sometime you could be in a situation where you could not trust your neighbor, that whatever you said could get back to the authorities in charge, and that you could lose your job, your income, and your home. Despite what my parents warned me about, I never thought I would face those kinds of fears here in the USA. But fear is fear. And now I agree you can't do much about those situations when there's a war going on. But it should not have to be that way in a peacetime economy. We should have the right
to discuss unionization without duress. We should have the right to discuss ways to improve the workplace without losing that workplace. Yet page 4 of our company handbook states that we are hired at will and that we can be terminated at the company's will at any time, anywhere, with no reason given. And unless you have a union job, you have a terminated will job. At the same time, some of us discussed going union. I was diagnosed with cancer of the left eye. I've since undergone treatment and will soon find out if it was successful. In the meantime, I am on unpaid medical leave. Do I dare speak out for unions, possibly losing my medical benefits, the right to go back to my job? Next month, I'm going to be 60 years old. How many jobs do you think there are in Central Oregon for bus drivers my age, especially one-eyed ones? I mean, how secure does that make me feel? You folks have the opportunity to rectify a long overdue situation in a state that has always stood for giving its citizens a chance to improve their lives, their workplaces, and their communities. 40 paratransit fellow employees want the city of Bend to have the best transit system possible. A majority of us agreed in an election that a union gives us the most successful avenue for doing so. This bill will give us the legal rights to pursue our objectives, to freely express our opinions, and to better our lives without losing everything we've worked so hard for. Unless you have any questions, thank you very much.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for letting me speak. I really only want 3 minutes. I started off with a...
Excuse me, sir. You have to identify yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Roger Olson, and I'm a former employee of a company called Boydston Metalworks. It's in Portland. Before I started off, I think I started off with about a 12-minute speech and then cut it in half to 6 and then in half again to 3. And after listening to the...
You can use your talents in that area in this building.
Thank you. I'll try. After listening to the doctor speak, I became a little bit more motivated to just... speaking instead of reading something that I'd wrote, because, as I said, I cut it in half and half again. Everything that the doctor said as he sat here was something I could relate to in every way. I could even add to what he said. I have been through a lot, and it's hard to talk about. It really is. I've been through being isolated. I've been through
just take your time.
Thank you. I've been through things like seeing an employer pin one race against another. Excuse me. I decided I wanted to organize a labor union in my place of employment, and a company that I'd been at for a few years, and which was a long time because the turnover rate was so high. And I was taken out and I was placed into another building to be kept from doing what I was doing, where I spent over 8 months in that building, where I was written up weekly until I was suspended and given a last chance agreement. And I went through the first election. We had 78 cards signed, and we had 103 voters, and it came out a 52-51 loss for the union. And because of unfair labor practice charges, we were able to show that, you know, the employer had come through and had threatened people of their jobs. There was a lot of corruption. I mean, just to a level I just don't even know how to say. But it has caused me to have problems since then. It's caused me to live a lot more isolated. It's caused me to live afraid. I was finally diagnosed a couple of years ago with having a PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And I deal with that daily, and it's gotten a lot better. But I did go through 3 elections. We were awarded rerun elections. The first election was a loss of 1 vote. The second election was a loss of, I believe, two votes, and a third of the election was a landslide victory for the employer. But prior to that, I could see that we were losing motivation. We were losing support. And I sat down with my employer trying to work something out. I explained to him that union organizing efforts don't exist in environments where the wages are good, the ethics are good, and the treatment and the benefits are good. Just any of those three. And he looked at me without a care in the world. And it was shortly thereafter I was fired. I'm sorry for the lack of structure in my speech, but this is really very hard for me to talk about. So, thank you.
I think you're doing great. Are you working now?
Yes, I am, and I'm proud to be a sheet metal worker with Local 16.
Yeah, God bless you. Any questions for these gentlemen? All right, then. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Ricardo Rodriguez, Brian DeLashman, and Betty Buckman. Ricardo, you want to go ahead and start things off here?
Yeah, sure. Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ricardo Rodriguez. I work for Maryville Nursing Home as a restorative aide. I'm a CNA too, certified nursing assistant. And I just was in a nasty battle with my company, with Maryville Nursing Home, Roman Catholic-owned nursing home. And we tried to organize our part of the organizing committee for our union. And everything that was put on the board by the doctor was used against us. I have been writing up for any excuse. Some of my co-workers too, part of the organizing committee. The battle was just nasty. In the beginning was the carrot and the stick. They were trying, promising everything, telling us that we were going to have better staffing, that we were going to start giving our residents instead of juice, like before. They were giving them Kool-Aid, so we demand for them to change that. They did. But we knew that they were just playing games. At the beginning, when they were friendly, when they noticed that things were not changing, that we were really for organizing our union and having our election, they began to hire three people from anti-union staff from Los Angeles who came and talked to us, who forced us to go into meetings where they were just talking bad about the union, talking about the employers, letting us know that even if we win the election, the administration was not willing to negotiate. That what was the case of all this work if they were not willing to do anything for us? Things got out of hand. There were so many unfair labor practices that we filed with the National Labor Board that we had to stop our election. We're still and right now working on our case. And it seems like we're going to have our hearing at the Labor Board on May 15. But the situation is, as all the speakers have said, it's not right for us employees to be fighting for our rights. I came from Mexico, and I will expect this level of corruption in a country like Mexico, and where the unions are sold, and there is no freedom or democracy, really. And I'm really shocked, and I'm sad that in order to organize our labor in America, we have to go through all these. It reminds me of Stalin. The employers have all the resources to fight against employees. They lie. They spend as much money as possible. So that's why I'm here today, because I want to support the Worker Freedom Act. I think that is needed. We have to level the field. The field is not level. The employees have to go up the hill, and the employers just, with all the money they have, they don't have to worry about anything but talking bad about the unions. I guess America, as we know, needs organized labor. We need to defend our middle class, even if I feel more like going down instead of middle class. And I know that labor board and the unions will help us progress and have a decent wages, decent benefits, and a decent working relations between the employers and employees. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betty Buckman. I am a certified nursing assistant, a CNA at Providence Portland Medical Center for 34 years. I live at 16522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland, Oregon. I am appearing in support for HB 2891, 2892, and 2893. As a CNA, I'm a primary caregiver for patients at the hospital. My job includes bathing, walking, taking vital signs, reporting any problems to the nurses and doctors, and my most important job is listening to each of the persons I take care of and to give them the human touch that they deserve. The state money that the hospital receives to care for patients should go directly for that. Our hospital should be accountable to the state government. They do not receive scarce tax dollars to spend on anti-union activity, but care for patients. Since we began organizing our union at Providence Health System, there has been a wealth of misinformation put out by our management. They have sent out memos and spread misinformation about our union during meetings. They tell people that the workers will be making less money if we have a union. And there is no one there from the SEIU to answer people's questions or concerns. That's why HB 2892 is important in making sure that employees are not forced to attend meetings where incorrect information is given. 2 days ago, I received a letter from the CEO of Providence Health System, Russ Danielson, saying that they support open communication in the hospital, but union supporters are not allowed to meet in the hospital, break rooms, or in non-patient areas before or after work. Union representatives are never at the meetings where management talks about union organizing. The NLRB doesn't outline the basic fairness that we want to have at our hospital. It doesn't enforce equal time for the employer and our union representative. It doesn't protect us from meetings that take away time from our patients to hear only one side of the story. It doesn't prevent Providence from using patient care dollars in hiring high-priced lawyers and consultants like Jackson Lewis to train managers. It's important that HB 2892 and 2893 are one step in leveling that playing field. And I'm here today to ask each of you for your yes vote on both of these bills. Thank you.
That's Southeast 162nd and Clinton?
Yes.
That sounds familiar. Very good. Thank you. Brian, go ahead.
For the record, Brian DeLashman here representing the Oregon Nurses Association. I'll be very brief. You're hearing from the actual workers, and I'm here because one of the workers that wanted to attend could not come all the way from Ontario, and I've got a letter from her. But over the last number of years, actually, I've been with ONA for 28 years. I've heard stories like you've been hearing today for 28 years. Over the last several years, we've had organizing efforts in Ontario, Roseburg, and in Lebanon, and the examples you're hearing are examples that we hear on a regular basis, all the way from intimidation to firing to threat of firing. But the one that I found really humorous, and you may not recognize who brought this, but the Joe Burkota, that's the letter from the nurse in Ontario. But look at the picture. One of the levels of intimidation is she parks in the parking lot the day of the election as an observer, and the observer for the hospital parks within 100 yards of her. That person's car is not booted, but the nurse's car is booted, even though it followed the policy of the hospital because she was not an employee that day. She was an observer. She parked in the visitor's parking lot. This is the kind of stuff that happens. And so we just we wanted to show you the picture of her finally getting her car unbooted. And with that, I'll end my testimony.
Any questions? Any questions for this panel?
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else like to testify to House Bill 2893 today? Don, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Don Schoenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Having looked at the bill and had some questions about the bill, the term purpose of the meeting, my question is, you know, who determines the purpose of the meeting? Ms. Trussell talked about lawsuits being kind of one-sided, or the attorney fees being one-sided. It seemed like in many cases it might result in lawsuits to determine whether that was the purpose of the meeting or not. You can start a meeting, and if an employee would change the subject, then maybe the meeting, the subject of the meeting changes because the employee changed the meeting, the subject of the meeting, and so another employee might determine, well, that was the real purpose of the meeting, was something else other than what you may have said it was. Or how do you determine what the purpose of the meeting is? Is there an agenda that determines what that purpose is? To me, this seems like a lot of this is awfully subjective, and if there was a way to make it more objective, that would be, I think, a step in the right direction. A lot of our employers don't employ a lot of people. They have one or two employees, maybe, and they have they work along right beside them, and so they have a very good working relationship with them. And while this bill, as it's drafted, I would conclude does not violate free speech, certainly, but I think it comes awful close to it. And it certainly would chill the relationships, I think, that employers and employees have, at least in our type of setting. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Thank you for the opportunity to express our concerns today.
Thanks, Don. And this whole process is about the exchange of ideas. And if anyone has any ideas to make this bill more clear, add clarity, more objective, more fair, so we can ensure workers have a place they can go and work and not feel threatened or be harassed, and still have conversations about organizing a union or not organizing a union without threat of losing their job, I think the proponents of this bill would welcome to have that conversation from anyone who would make this bill better. And I would encourage everyone to do that. And you're all going to have a chance to do that. You all see one another in the hallway, and I encourage you to work together to make it even better for a healthier, better, stronger work environment for workers and employers here in the state of Oregon. Any questions for Mr. Schoenberg? Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And if there's none, I'm going to... Anyone else like to speak to this bill? We will be hearing it again. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2893. I'm going to open the hearing on House Bill 2892. And I'm going to call Hillary Mortensen and Jeanette Bethune, please. Go ahead. Identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair Scheffler and committee. My name is Hillary Mortensen. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm here today to testify on behalf of House Bills 2893, 2891, 2892, and Resolution HJM7. Along with my testimony, there was an authorization card that was passed out to all of you, and we just wanted to show you what workers are signing in order to show that they would like a union in their workplace. It's a card that very clearly explains what they want. Now I'd just like to share my story. When I worked at Early Head Start Family Services of Portland, Oregon, in November of 2002, my coworkers and I started conversations about forming a union. The main reason behind that was respect. We didn't feel like management respected us as the people who worked in the classrooms with the children. By February of 2003, we had a strong majority. Over 50% of my coworkers and I wanted a union, so we filed for a petition. But it wasn't until June of 2003 that we were able to hold that election. It ended on a good note. We did bring in the union, form the union, 2-1. But up until June, we dealt with captive audience meetings where the director of our program, Cynthia Wells, first said that she would quit if a union was brought into the workplace. And then when people asked her questions about her position on the union or what it would mean for Head Start, she told people that either they didn't care about the children and that's why they wanted a union, or they just didn't know any better because they came from a union family and it was all they'd ever grown up knowing. Once she saw that that didn't work and we pressed on, she resorted to what I like to call high school tactics. She started glaring, grunting, snorting at us anytime she saw people who were for the union. And I actually worked in the same building as she did, so every morning I would say hello to her, she would grunt at me. She is the same age as my mother, so.
That's how some people treat me in this building.
I'm sorry.
I'm used to
hear that.
The difference is you deserve it.
That's quite true.
Thank you. So after that, Ms. Wells decided that she needed to do an investigation into whether a union was really something that would benefit employees, which led us to a 12-day hearing with the NLRB over 3 weeks. No one sat on the stand for less than 4 hours, and most people sat on the stand for up to 8 hours. I was one of those individuals that sat on the stand for 4 hours while the attorney that Ms. Wells hired, Jacqueline Dam from the firm of Bullard, Smith, Gersted, and Wilson, had me clearly define what my role was in the classroom, and it was upsetting to me that my employer was using funds that should have been put back into the program to help care for the families and the children that we cared for. And these are low-income, high-risk, high-needs kids. And she spent well over $50,000 doing this investigation and having this attorney find out if a union was good for early Head Start, but ultimately belittling us and making, I can personally say, I felt like she tried to make it sound like I wouldn't know when to breathe if the lead teacher in my classroom hadn't been there. And the saddest part is that the amount of effort that the employees put into trying to form the union and the amount of money that Ms. Wells put into trying to prevent the union from being formed have seriously, seriously damaged the program to the point where Early Head Start no longer exists. It's now, it had to be taken over by CDI, which is a Head Start corporation that comes in to help Head Start organizations that are financially in trouble because of the money that she spent. And now there are repairs on buildings that needed to be done that money should have been used to do that. And many, many employees no longer work there because of the stress of going through that campaign. So I'd just like to thank you for your time.
Go ahead, ma'am.
My name is Jeanette Bethune, and I am an employee at Early Head Start in Portland. I've been there for 13 years. I want you to know how important these bills are to so many of us who've already been through a campaign to organize. We would wish to prevent others from the emotional stress that was put on the workers. Being an Early Head Start employee requires us to engage in supporting children and families in difficult situations, domestic violence, homelessness, and poverty. This deserves our full attention and not the distractions and added stress of an employer who was willing to spend approximately $64,000, I'm up from Hillary's, and that was from the board, on federal, state, and county grant funding money to fight the rights of its employees to form a union. We felt this money could have been spent for those who have worked with children and families in a much better manner. During this fight, we did go to the NLRB hearings and to testify to prove who should and should not be in the bargaining unit. Early Head Start management was claiming that over half of its employees were supervisors and had no right to a union. Well, the NLRB ruled in our favor and saw that everyone that worked in the classroom together was a team, and none of the teachers, development assistants, or teachers' assistants were supervisors. But this ruling took its toll and the time that it took. The 12-day hearing was the second largest in Ask Me, or longest in Ask Me's history. And during this process, we lost many, many valued, well-trained staff that could no longer cope with the stress of going through this drawn-out process. I chose to form a union with my coworkers, a group of about 75 predominantly women. We wanted to gain respect. We wanted to help ourselves with our benefits, our wages, and our working conditions. But most of all, we wanted to have a voice at the table with management. It was through no force from the union that I came to these decisions. However, the verbal and emotional abuse was yielded by my employer left a very negative impact on me and exacerbated some very serious mental conditions for me. Prior to our effort to form a union, I'd always received excellent reviews for 13 years. They considered me an excellent teacher. I received praise for my high level of skills in the classrooms with children and with families. I was considered a team player that went beyond what was expected. But after management had marked me as a union supporter, my next review was very unkind and unsatisfactory, to say the least. Excuse me. This was not something that had happened to just me, but to all the other employees who had shown support for the union. A few anti-union staff began a campaign against the majority of us that was very disrespectful. On one occasion, we received an email sent to all staff eligible to be in the bargaining unit. It accused us of lying and told us that God would judge us. When complaints of this went to management, we were told that it was just what happens when you unionize and we should just toughen up. While the individuals were not reprimanded, the rest of us were told that we were not to use company time or equipment to discuss union business, but their efforts continued. A senior management person leaving her position came to us to say that during her weekly meetings, they discuss ways to fire union supporters. This has left me with a lasting impact, and that impact is to continue to stand up for workers' rights, and these bills do just that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Groner. You'd like to come up, Ralph Groner. And before you get started, this is federal, state, and local tax dollars that are being used.
Through a grant process.
Right. What I would like to request of you is the name and business address of this individual and invite them to come before this committee and explain their use of this money in this way. I would like to give them the opportunity to come and express what they did and why they did and defend themselves. So if you get that information to me, I personally will invite them to this committee room to explain their use of our tax dollars. Go ahead, Ralph.
Chair Scheffler, are you in regards to the director of the program or
anybody who you think spent this money this way, I would like them to come and explain why they did what they did with our tax dollars. Okay. Give them the opportunity to defend themselves or not. And if they don't show up, that's their business. Thank you. Go ahead, Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I wasn't going to testify on this. I was going to leave it up to the folks. However, I have personal knowledge, although they may not have known that at the members. At the time, I'm Ralph Groner with Ask Me, for the record. And I'm the political staff. However, I have intimate knowledge of the organizing drive for Head Start in Portland. And the reason was Deborah Kidney at that time, who was helping to organize this potential local, came to me and said, Ralph, I really need you to look at some things. So I looked at the emails and the literature that had gone out, and I couldn't believe, is all I'm going to tell you, what I saw at this time. So I said, being political, give me a list of who's on the board. If they didn't, I could have found out anyway. I found out the chair of the board, I forgot her name, it was Happy Valley, my county. I called her. She said, please send me what you've received from Deborah, from management, through the Bullard firm. And then I said, I have figures here for what they've paid to the Bullard firm, which you had attested to. I became upset, so I called my dear friend, former senator who was on the board, Senator Vern Duncan. At that point, that went back and forth between our staff and the board of Head Start. Their call back to me was, we can't believe what we're seeing. This can't have happened by Senator, former Senator Vern Duncan. And shortly thereafter, if I recall, the Bullard firm was removed from no, they weren't. Okay, I thought they were going to remove the Bullard firm, or at least the lawyer. And that, all I have to say is my knowledge of this was intimate in that I became involved in the middle of reading this unbelievable literature that I think I'm fairly a nice guy. And it takes a lot, I think, to really get me upset. This went far beyond that. And at that point, I can attest to the fact that two of the board members that I contacted were upset also, not only with what was said and stated to employees, but the cost. So I'm only testifying as to the veracity of the comments, because these folks were being organized. I was on the side of trying to help my organizer, Deborah Kidney, who could testify here as well, as to what the problem was. And you've heard what the problem was. And that was why, by the way, Ask Me put a bill in last session dealing with not allowing public money to be used in campaigns either for or against a union. And the reason was we saw this tremendous abuse of taxpayer dollars that I couldn't believe I was seeing, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And since then, of course, we found out that that's happened elsewhere in the state, and it happens in the private sector. But the private sector's private money. This is taxpayer money, many of whom, by the way, are union members who pay these taxes. And I don't believe that the voters of Oregon said that you could go out and use taxpayer money when, in fact, it should be going for Head Start and kids to do the very venomous, bitter, kind of disrespectful of humans kind of campaign that was run. And the director was directly involved in that. So was the law firm of Bullard. And quite frankly, the only thing I felt good about was the fact that I found a couple board members who agreed at least with what we were saying. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Ralph. And I would like that. I hope you've kept all that information. I'd like to see it myself and share it with the committee. Thank Any you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. All right. Some folks with another perspective, maybe, maybe not. Jeff Dean, Lisa Trussell, Jessica Adamson. Please come forward. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. And, Mr. Chair, I want to first start off again by saying that we are a union open shop association, leaves an opportunity for all, and that just on a personal level, for some of the stories that we have heard today, our association doesn't advocate that kind of behavior, and it's appalling to us to hear about that. It's not the kind of behavior that we would ever encourage our employees, or our employers rather, to undertake, and so please know that's not at all the kind of behavior that we would say is appropriate.
And just for the record, I believe you, and I don't think anyone in this committee would cast that kind of shadow on your association, so I just want to share that with you, or any of the associations being represented here at this panel today. Thank you. So, carry on.
Thank you. The concerns that we have with this bill deal with the fact that it isn't entirely clear that public improvement contracts are not covered under this legislation, and we have some contractors that all they do is work for the state, and particularly ODOT. Those contracts that they receive, they provide the service, and then they build in some profit to that that comes back to their company, and that essentially becomes private dollars. It is not those activities, whether to become to organize or not, that kind of activity doesn't happen on the public public job side, but the money that those folks receive, the profits they receive from contracts, we would contend that those become private dollars after the contract is closed out. What we're concerned about with this bill is this would create a situation where those folks that are on those job sites or work, you know, generally solely for ODOT, wouldn't be able to encourage or dissuade their employees one way or the other, or participate when it comes to that, because their sole source of revenue is from state contracts. And for those that do even a portion of their work on a public, again, a public contracting standpoint, not the Head Start scenario and not the Medicaid or Medicaid care scenario, but on a project-by-project basis, even if they do portions of their work that way, this would create a two separate bookkeeping scenario of what state projects did I have, what revenues did I receive from those projects versus what private or non-state contracts did I have, and what revenues did I receive from those projects. And we would view that as cumbersome. We can understand perhaps the Head Start scenario and the contracts that are ongoing service contracts. That may be a different situation, but I think from the construction industry standpoint, this bill is problematic.
Yeah, and Jessica, thank you. I might see your colleagues nodding their head. I agree with you. I think I'm a contractor. Once I get paid to do something, it's my money. Mm-hmm. And that's not what I'm interpreting this bill as doing. This is, we heard just now, somebody took tax dollars and treated these workers, allegedly treated them. I say allegedly because I wasn't there, so I want some proof. And I think I'll probably get it. And somehow I think you should, and I was going to wait, but I think we can work with the proponents. You can work with the proponents of this bill and somehow clarify if someone's contracting with the state. Once they're paid for their job, that's their money now. Mm-hmm. That's no longer state money.
Correct.
I think you can draw a line there somehow. And I'm not a lawyer, but I'm glad you are. So, Mr. Dean, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm not an attorney. I won't take on that label.
I thought you were. Well, you're smart enough to be one.
Oh, thank you. We are happy to work with the proponents to create that clarity in
great.
This bill. That's
good. Thank you. Mr. Dean, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Dean. I work for the Associated Builders and Contractors. Our concerns with this bill are largely identical to those expressed by Jessica. Our concern deals specifically with our members who perform public works construction are paid by a public agency from a public source. Mm-hmm. At that point, we do feel that the dollars become private, and we are concerned with the way that this bill is written. It might stop them from being allowed to put their side of the story before their employees while simultaneously allowing union organizers to have free access to the company. And we certainly understand that union organizing will take place. It's going to continue to take place. But our employers want the opportunity to at least be able to say their side of the story and make their case. So.
Lisa?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and the concerns are very similar. Our members are not just construction people, though, but we have people that contract with the state for providing services or goods, and it's after you expressed that the payment's been made for the exchange of paper or service, then didn't want to include that the profit from that would be considered tax money or state money.
Great. I hope that can be done. I think we can do that. I hope we can. Any questions of this panel? Anyone in the committee want to disagree with me? That's fine. Open to that too. Go ahead, Representative Holby.
Thanks. Mr. Dean, you just said something. I got a clarify or something. You said that union organizers have free access to your contractors?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I should clarify that a little bit better. We do have members that have unions attempt to organize them. Some have succeeded, some have failed. What this bill, the way that we are reading it, would interpret is that if a union organizer decided to, for whatever reason, attempt to organize one of our companies, and if they were doing work on a public project, the union would, there's nothing in this bill that says that prohibits the union in any way from engaging in an organizing activity. However, it does significantly handcuff the employer from providing any other information to their employees. Any counterarguments to what is being explained by the union?
Only using tax dollars. Can't use state tax dollars to do it.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We do understand that. And Jessica kind of touched on the issue. We feel that the only way to avoid this scenario would be to require companies to keep two books, one that specifically recorded the public money that was coming in and one that specifically recorded the private.
Well, we'll see where we go. Representative Holvey, did you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum, any questions?
No, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. All righty then. Anyone else like to testify to this bill? Nope. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2892. Open up public hearing on House Bill 2891. And I'm going to call Janice Lynch, Richard Swartz, and John Lepink. I hope I got that right. Lepink. Forgive me if I didn't. Go ahead, Janice, please.
Hi, I'm Janice Lynch, and I live in Clackamas, Oregon. And I work for Singular Wireless and Avenue AT&T over there in the Promenade in Clackamas.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, let's see, I've been actually worked for AT&T, was AT&T Wireless since August of 2003. At that time, it was AT&T Wireless, then Singular, now it's the new AT&T. I'm a member of Communications Workers of America, Local 7901. At the time I first became aware of the CWA, I was working at the AT&T Wireless call center in downtown Portland. When I worked for AT&T Wireless, I saw some people getting annual raises like me, but others didn't, and I didn't understand it, and I didn't think it was very right. I saw inconsistent treatment of my coworkers that had nothing to do with job performance. As AT&T Wireless was being acquired by Singular, a lot of things were changing, and not for the better. In June of 2005, I was handed a flyer by an organizer, and I had a conversation with her. By the end of the discussion, I thought a union at Singular was a great idea. I thought a union would make a difference for all of us. I wanted to know more, and I wanted to help, so I became an inside committee member. As a committee member, we would talk with our coworkers about being part of the CWA. In training, we learned about the card check neutrality agreement between CWA and Singular, an agreement that has been in effect for almost 10 years. Some of the details of the agreement are, number one, neutrality means the company agrees and shall so instruct all appropriate managers that the company will remain neutral and will neither assist nor hinder the union on the issue of union representation. Two, once a month, the company provides the union the name, address, and telephone numbers of all of the workers at the call center. Three, after giving the company 21 days notice, the union can have access to the workplace for up to 60 days. And number four, the workers merely sign a card specifying CWA as their collective bargaining agent and that they understand they are already part of a collective bargaining agreement. Once a majority of signed cards are collected, they are sent to an arbitrator in Atlanta, Georgia, who asks the company for a current list of the workers at the call center. The arbitrator compares the card to the list and confirms a majority of workers have signed a card. However, the former AT&T Wireless supervisors and managers were not happy. That was because there was a neutral agreement, and some showed that they had displeasure. Even so, we never saw an anti-union posters on company bulletin boards, never sat through one-on-one meetings with our team managers, or large anti-union meetings with call center management, or threats of closing the call center. As one of the 25 leaders of the organizing drive, I was never harassed or intimidated. My supervisor was neutral, not intimidating. Other supervisors were intimidating and watching our activities, but they didn't have an impact on our campaign. Even though we had neutrality, we still had to have a meaningful conversations with our coworkers to educate them about unions in general and CWA in particular, and that their yes vote was by signing the card. It was a big decision to bring a union into our work lives. Of course, not everyone I approached wanted to have a conversation about having a union, but there were no organized campaigns to keep the union out. Within 3 weeks of collecting cards, we had more than a majority. By Wednesday, after Labor Day in 2005, we were certified by the arbitrator and 450 call center workers were part of the CWA.
When I found out we were certified, I was ecstatic. I felt we had done a good job of educating our coworkers, and for the first time, we would have some say in our workplace, which hadn't been there before. We knew what our wages and medical benefits would be, and we would now have a voice on the job to deal with inconsistent treatment. By November 2005, 200 workers at 26 singular retail stores in Oregon, from Medford to Warrington to Portland Metro to the Dalles, also became part of the CWA under agreement. Card check neutrality brings fairness to the decision on whether to have a union in a workplace. I don't think we could have done this without card check neutrality. By the way, between August 2005 and February 2006, over 17,000 former AT&T wireless workers became part of the CWA under card check neutrality nationwide.
God bless everyone. Thank you.
And I need to excuse myself just because I have to be at work.
I understand. No, I understand. Got to make a living.
Sir, could I just ask one question?
Roosevelt.
Sure. Thank you, Janice. It's good to see you, and good to see a fellow CWA member here. Thanks for your testimony.
You.
I just wanted to ask you how this new merger with and becoming the new AT&T is affecting this neutrality agreement. Will it continue under the new?
Yes. I don't think anything functionality and those kind of things are going to change. It's mostly just going to be the name, because AT&T basically is more world known.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I know, a lot of the other things aren't going to change. And we're not seeing any changes or differences at this point dealing with the union. So it looks good.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Have a nice evening.
Thank
Go
you.
Ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Schwartz. I'm the Executive Director of the American Federation of Teachers Oregon. I've submitted written testimony that you may have in front of you. I'm going to finish identifying who we are and then give you a few examples from my experience in organizing about the issue of recognition, voluntary recognition under existing statutes, and how that would be changed with majority sign-up, or as it's often referred to as card check recognition. AFT Oregon represents over 12,000 workers in K-12, community college, and higher education in faculty and classified positions in Oregon, and as well represents healthcare workers and child care providers. And our healthcare workers are employed by Kaiser Permanente, who has similar majority sign-up or card check recognition that's been has been working successfully for a number of years and was referenced in earlier testimony on House Bill 2893. The point that's often missed in this whole debate about card check or majority sign-up is the fundamental right in the Collective Bargaining Act, or Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act in Oregon, and that is the whole act is built around one section, 243.662, which sets forth that public employees have the right to form, join, and participate in the activities of labor organizations of their own choosing for the purpose of collective bargaining on matters concerning employment relations. There is nothing in that section, nothing in that core statement in the statute that says employers have the right to do that, or employers have the right to determine who the union shall, or whether the employees shall unionize, or if they should have a union, and who that union should be. The right belongs to employees. Elections are in that context only because employers choose not to give voluntary recognition. Elections are there to resolve a dispute over whether or not the union, the employees, have achieved majority status, and it takes majority status to get voluntary recognition. So one point I'd like to make is that majority sign-up is actually a higher standard than the election or the secret ballot election that everybody else has referred to here today and in other conversations. Majority means that the union has to be have been designated explicitly by a majority of employees in an appropriate bargaining unit. An election that everybody, that opponents of these bills want to push this back onto, only require that a majority of those who vote vote for representation. So you could have a representation election that has 60% turnout, and if a majority of that 60% vote for the union, then you have representation. So where we're asking for card check or majority sign-up, we're actually suggesting a higher standard that the union has to meet in the case of getting card check or majority sign-up recognition. And the ultimate value in this is the time and the removal of wasted public resources that employers utilize to delay when they routinely and perfunctorily reject card check recognition. By the way, my experience covers more than 30 years in this, in public, private, and federal sector, and public sector in more than just Oregon and multiple NLRB regions across the country. And the stories I've heard and the testimony brought back lots of memories from personal experience when I was an employee in the private sector and subject to the machinations of a union-busting firm, and all the way through running into the same firm in an organizing campaign later on as a union staff person. But let me give you some examples of what's happened with the ability that the employer has to reject voluntary recognition in campaigns we've had in recent years. In May 2002, we received 77 cards explicitly authorizing our affiliate, Local 6200, associated or academic professionals at Eastern Oregon University to represent faculty and librarians on that campus of the Oregon University system. That number was about 59% of the 130 employee bargaining unit. We requested voluntary recognition as contemplated in the Act, and that was perfunctorily rejected, even though the Oregon University system had about 7,000 employees, which it has today, under collective bargaining agreements, and has been involved in collective bargaining negotiations with unions of one or, for one group or another employees for over 25 years at that time. It still declined to grant voluntary recognition. Now, that employer used that opportunity, which is what happens when an employer can reject a majority demonstration on authorization cards, as a doorway to conduct a campaign and either organized or either in a concerted effort or indirectly through actions of supervisors and other agents of the employer to dissuade employees from organizing. That's the window or the doorway that that opens up when it has the right to not grant recognition, even in the face of a demonstrable majority of employees. In that particular case, the employer used that opportunity to oppose representation, to imply promises of changes in its behavior, and to generally and publicly oppose that explicit designation made by a majority of employees. All of its positions that it produced at the Employment Relations Board hearing as a prelude to the election, it failed to prevail on any of them. Nevertheless, it then opposed that result and moved for oral argument in front of the ERB, where it also failed to prevail on any of its issues. The subsequent election wasn't conducted until February 2003, 9 months after that substantial majority of employees requested voluntary recognition. The election outcome was a 58% majority. It delayed then its negotiations and allowed an opportunity for employees opposed to representation to file a decertification petition, which we went through and prevailed by an even larger percentage.
Sir, it's 5:30. I think everybody up here agrees with you.
Okay.
Can you sum this up? I'm guessing here. My name's on the bill, and I think these people are too. So can we sum this up?
My written testimony includes a number of similar examples where large majorities of employees indicated their on explicit cards indicated their preference for the union, and which the public employers rejected, and which we won by overwhelming majorities in subsequent elections. One thing I want to mention as well is that if, on the rare occasion in the public sector, but not uncommon occasion in the private sector, as a parallel, an employer engages in conduct that's so pollutes the atmosphere that a rerun election can't be conducted fairly in the board's determination, its source for determining whether or not the union should be certified is the authorization cards, the same cards that are used to request voluntary recognition from the employer. What this bill does and what we're asking this committee to support is that when the union makes a demonstrable, explicit demonstration of majority status, that the employer be required to grant that recognition.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is John Lepink. I'm from Beaverton, Oregon. I'm a member of SEIU, Local 503, Subunit 109, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm a fisheries biologist there at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have been for 17 years. Prior to that, I was a fish and wildlife biologist in Utah for 18 years. I don't know if you know it or not, but Utah is a right-to-work state. While I was in Utah, I was a president of the local of the Public Employees Association, and you talk about hard time getting people organized here. Utah is a little bit different story. So anyhow, but I have been an activist for a number of years. And in September of 2002, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife employees and union organizers identified problems within ODFW and the need for organization and a contract to help solve these problems. Today I want to relate probably a little bit different scenario of what you've been hearing here, what happens when management is asked to keep their hands off during the organization process. And one of the things that made the process easy at ODFW was that the union, through the governor, negotiated an agreement with ODFW management that they would remain neutral toward the organization process. This meant that they would not engage in threatening employees involved in the unionization process or those employees that were pro-union. Although this was the official position of ODFW, individual managers did indicate to their subordinates that if the union came in, things would be worse and the individual employees would not be able to do their job and could possibly suffer because of supporting the union. In spite of this opposition, on April 15, 2003, 8 months after the organization process started, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife employees filed for union election with the State Employment Relations Board. This is through the CARD process. If the process that you're talking about would have been in place at that time, we would have organized at that time, became it. Part of the union at that time, but we had to hold an election, and at the same time we were in the process of moving from Portland to Salem, a large portion of our people, and as a result of that we lost about 10% of our people, got either changed jobs or something happened to them. So between the time we got the cards and the time we held the election, we had to go back and re-educate a lot of people on why we wanted a union, and as a result the election was a lot closer than it would have been if we'd had just the cards at that time. But on July 4th of 2003, ODFW employees voted overwhelmingly to form a union. Of those voting, 80% supported joining the union. Representative employees then entered into bargaining, and in early December, we had a contract ready for ratification. And on January 22nd of 2004, the contract was signed. That's 1 year and 8 months after we first started organization process. And about 4 months of that was taken up with the time between we got the cards in and we had the election. So the process could have been a lot shorter, and we could have been sitting down with management and discussing our problems, getting those problems solved a lot sooner if we'd have done with the card check rather than go for the organization. So one of the other things that you might want to know about this was that when we became a union, we were in a price freeze. Everybody that became a member of the union actually took a pay cut because now they were paying union dues and they knew they weren't going to get a raise for another 2 years. So that's how important it was for those people to join a union. They were able to work through all of that. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer. Thank you for your time.
For these gentlemen? Yeah, Representative Holby.
I know the hour is late, Mr. Chair, but I really thank everybody for testifying, but I think there's one point that has been brought up that, is if even with these bills, there's still the big problem of getting that contract, and oftentimes, getting that contract can take such a long time that those efforts can be thwarted. And so although these bills don't fix that, I really commend the idea of card check. I really think it's time is way past and overdue, as the testimony has been pretty clear to me anyway. I'd like to see something done about making sure we get a contract at the end of the day, too.
I couldn't agree more. Representative Roosevelt.
Mr. Chair, I think one piece of legislation that we're not hearing today but that is on its way to this committee now is dealing with the Employee Free Choice Act, which is a bill in Congress
And that does deal with, in addition to some of the things we've talked about, the bargaining first contract problem. So we will be able to talk about that another day.
Thank you, Representative Edwards. Anything for you, or and sir, I don't want to, I didn't mean to minimize your testimony. I believe you. I agree with you. I just, it's late. We're all worn out. And in this building, if you get them agreeing with you, smile and move on. But I don't think these bills are great bills. Obviously, I support them. It's not going to be easy. There's a lot of work to do. And for those who had problems with any of these bills, I encourage them to go to the proponents and try and bring clarity and whatever else they think needs to be in there. And we're going to have another hearing on these. And I'm fairly confident we're going to have a work session on all three of them. And we're going to see what we can do for workers here in the state of Oregon. It's one of the benefits of sitting in this chair because I'm a worker, too. So if there's nothing more for these gentlemen, I'm going to thank you, and I'm going to close the public hearing on Hospital 2894, 2891. Anything for the good of the order? We'll be adjourned. Thank you.